Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, brother?
Doing great, man. It's cool in New York City.
It's cool. It's like a crisp fall weather almost.
Yeah,
it's kind of odd. I'm liking the drop. I'm not liking quite this much of a drop.
Yeah, dude. For colored folk, man, I need like a for colored folk who don't like hot weather support group.
Yeah, I have to say, in my experience of the community, that's a different attitude.
I don't like it here.
Yeah.
New York summers are the worst.
I like hot weather, and at some point, New York summer hot weather is a problem. Like, yeah. I don't think that's really dependent on what kind of weather you like.
I like it in Barbados.
Yeah, exactly. It's a brand up in New York.
Yes.
So now we got to get to the other brand up of the week, which is the real basic one.
Yeah, this is basic, and surprisingly, it's not an airline, you know, so we're laying off the airline
today. The F-up industry.
But it does come from a city that me and Michael actually were both at very recently.
Yes, sir.
We presented
we presented
a workshop at Sustainable Brands, so shout out to the Sustainable Brands crew that brought us out to Detroit to do a workshop around cultural gentrification and cultural amplification. And it's ironic that our brand F-Up literally comes from the world of gentrification. Obviously, Detroit is a city that has been dealing with tremendous financial challenges over more than the last decade, but most famously for the last decade. The counter story to that is that there's also been tremendous investment in Detroit, particularly the downtown core loop of Detroit. So just to name a couple of quick stats, and this is not connected to this story, but this will help set the stage. Right now in Detroit, there's capital investment slated of over $5.4 billion. That's development projects all from 2017 to 2020. This is going to include over 6,000 new apartment units, over 1,000 new hotel units, and 2.1 million square feet of new office space. So clearly, this is a city that people are throwing money and resources to. The question is, where and how are those resources serving a community that is still largely African American? And the downtown loop is being developed primarily for white people, gentrifiers, and those coming from outside of Detroit to move to Detroit. So Bedrock Detroit is a investment company, real estate company that's run by Dan Gilbert, who in pop culture world owns the Cleveland Cavaliers and Quicken Loans, I believe, and a couple other things. He's a Detroit native and has spent a lot of time, again, investing in this downtown loop. On one of their new projects, they had a huge installation poster displaying, and I want to read their logo correctly for how this was branded. It was called Detroit as We See It. And everyone in this ad was what you would picture, young, white, looking cosmopolitan, sipping martinis. And to, again, branding a new development in this way to a city that is still predominantly black and predominantly poor. More than 40% of Detroit is under the poverty line once you get out of that downtown loop is tone deaf, to say the least.
To say the beyond the least. I mean, you know, my sort of comedic angle is to say that, well, that is how they see Detroit. That's why they feel comfortable investing there now, right? I mean, I think it's kind of definitely one of those images that speaks actually tens of thousands of words and basically all of American history. You know, I mean, I know you'll get to the apology in a second, but we talk so much in our work, in our consulting with clients here, you know, even just about who's in the room. And when you're having a conversation with somebody about it, you know, the questions become a lot more subtle, like, oh, well, you know, they missed this nuance and this piece of a campaign because no one was there to hold that perspective. But we forget that, you know, And this other mistake was more benign. But just like with the spelling of Columbia, I think by Adidas, spelling, you know, the wrong way, spelling Columbia the wrong way in the country of Columbia. Like, there are times when it's like having someone in the room who also, by the way, I should add, someone in the room who feels comfortable and allowed to speak and can voice themselves is the difference, not between a important, significant, subtle and strategic breakthrough, but just basic, complete and utter fuckery and failure, which this ad is.
Yeah, and I'm not going to read the entire apology. It was posted on Facebook, on the Facebook page of Bedrock Detroit, because it's long. Number one, we don't have time for that.
Very long.
But I'll give just some highlights. It starts off, it says, "We screwed up badly the graphic package that was partially installed on the retail windows of the first floor of the Vinton building in downtown Detroit, a structure we have been rebuilding for over 2 years and is nearing completion. We messed up in two ways." Then they go on to highlight that they didn't want the ad to create the feelings that it did. And it does say that they've killed, it says in their words, "We've killed the See Detroit as We Do campaign." And then it goes on to say, "Who cares how we," in quotes, "see Detroit? What is important is that Detroit comes together as a city that is open, diverse, inclusive, and is being redeveloped in a way that offers opportunity for all its people and the expected numerous new residents that will flock to our energized, growing, job-producing town," so on and so forth. And then the second piece just said they didn't finish the full graphic installation and that there was going to be more diversity, we just didn't get a chance to see it.
Oh, and then the black section would be installed later. Yeah, the black section
would be installed later. So
that sounds really good.
That was sort of the gist of it. You know,
right.
I don't know. I didn't, and we'll have the apology posted in the notes. I didn't.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a valid apology, right?
Somewhat, right. Sure. You know,
somewhat ish.
Because they're still looking to fight the good fight, that this was not intentional and they have a vision for Detroit. And you know, we got a chance to interview and spend some time with Peter Moskowitz, who wrote How to Kill a City, and it's his story of gentrification through the lens of four cities, San Francisco, New York, New Orleans, and Detroit. And he talks a lot about how gentrification is not a function of individual choices. It's systemic, is a function of where we put resources, how we invest our financial and social capital. And obviously someone like Dan Gilbert is at the forefront of creating a Detroit that maybe he intends it to be inclusive, but if you don't address a whole host of other really serious issues, I wonder if it will actually achieve that. You know, and we also had a chance to interview Ingrid LaFleur, who's running for mayor of Detroit, a young woman, an artist, a Detroit native. So, you know, I think this apology is an opportunity for listeners to actually go back into our archives a little bit, maybe learn more about what's going on in Detroit and gentrification, and then judge the apology after they know a lot more about the city and how it's
developing.
Oh,
you'll judge it even more harshly if you listen to all that.
Probably.
No doubt. All right, now we got to get to what's up. Now we got to get to a piece of pop culture that has been causing a lot of controversy, a lot of debate on your feeds, and that's basically that Game of Thrones showrunners David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, along with husband and wife team Nichelle Tramble Spellman and Malcolm Spellman, are going to be or in the works to create a show, Confederate, for HBO. And Confederate takes place in an alternative history where the Civil War was sort of not won by the North. It wasn't, as far as I understand, not won by the South either. It's just we're still in a we're still in a split United States, and the South is still a complete plantation and slavery system, although, you know, presumably, obviously, technology and other things have moved forward. this caused a major backlash out of the gate. As an example, The author Roxane Gay was out of the gate. It's exhausting to think of how many people at HBO said yes to letting two white men envision modern day slavery and offensive. Actor David Harwood predicted there would be a boycott. And then there was just a lot of just kind of general sentiment of, you know, is this really like, does the sort of like the depiction of bondage and human ownership that is this defining, one of the kind of core defining realities, sins, and then policy templates of this country, does it need to be depicted in pop culture again, let alone, if it's not in the context of at least doing, you know, historical representation of what actually in fact did happen. I think more broadly, I think that I could imagine the other concern is this sort of like the reputation that these guys built up with Game of Thrones. This is going to be an incredibly brutal, grotesque viewing experience. There is the series on Amazon, Man in the High Castle, which is doing an alternative history as if, you know, Japan and the Nazis had won World War II, and there had been ongoing sort of global genocide. But that is definitely much more in the, you know, that sort of takes place in the kind of sci-fi realm in a different way. I feel like I don't have anything particularly, you know, my instinct is that this is the wrong time to make this show and it shouldn't be made, also because the kind, you know, we have a neo-Confederate attorney general, for Christ's sake. But I also don't know, you know, they've responded that there's a reason why they're doing this and they're excited to explore the material. I guess the only kind of counter program I could have to what seems to be the consensus, at least in our circles, is, you know, is it sufficient enough to prejudge this that these two guys should not be involved in any type of show that involves an alternative timeline on slavery? That's it. Period. Case closed. Done. Because if that's the case, it doesn't matter what they do and what they put together, or even, you know, theoretically how smart or persuasive the show is.
Yeah. I mean, when I first read this, and this has been discussed in so many different forums, immediately my reaction was, this is never going to get made. Like, HBO has whatever money they might have fronted them to do this and whatever their contracts might look like. HBO is the same network that invested $100 million in a season of Vinyl and canceled the show. And that show was terrible, right? You know, so it deserved to be canceled. But HBO has so much money and so many resources. I think ultimately they're going to bite the bullet on this. I'd be shocked if a year or two from now, by the time it takes to really develop this and cast and film and premiere, that this ever reaches the airwaves. So I think to a certain extent, some of the reaction has to be in the framework is that you're never going to see the show. But on the same time, it's even disturbing to think that with all of the resources that HBO has at their disposal, the real challenges that HBO has as a network on finding like their next big hit. Game of Thrones is over in another now 12 episodes. We've already seen two. By the time this airs, 11 episodes will be left total on Game of Thrones. There is no huge monoculture hit on their bench right now. Even something that I thought was terrible, like Girls, which I hated, was at least the type of show that got them conversation points in a certain
Silicon Valley gets some conversation
in a certain market.
Points. If we're but going
it's not a it's not a monoculture huge hit. HBO is not going to survive on 30 minutes of Silicon Valley. It needs an hour long prestige show that's going to every year HBO wants to see. We won the most amount of Golden Globe nominations and Emmy nominations. That's their thing. They're the leaders of prestige TV. and their bench is thin. And this show ain't bringing it back. And so that's a completely business perspective on
why isn't the show bringing it back?
Why are they even going down this road? This show is never going to happen. That's my prediction.
Why do you think it wouldn't bring it back if it was
because it's
production?
Because it's not going to be good.
Why?
There's no way in my mind this show can be good because people have never tackled what slavery is. And so when I read the byline of the story and interviews and subsequent stuff, I was like, they're still setting up this false narrative of a Southern despotic place that was burdened with slavery and this like good do-gooder North,
right,
that fought this right. war. And that is not historically accurate. Slavery developed with both the entire country profiting from it.
But
the
bodies might
have existed in the South, but the finance.
So the
came
only
from
thing
the
I'm so the, and I'm not so okay. The merits, you're obviously 1,000% right, but obviously things being historically inaccurate and racially wrong have never stopped things from being successful in the past. I guess I'm just the devil's advocate position that I would play is like I think that there's three different possibilities here. I think that it's very likely, I'm not as confident as you are, but I think it's pretty likely the thing isn't going to happen. And good, because this isn't a risk that needs to be taken now. So yeah. That's my, right? Like, that's just my kind of bottom line. I'm not even excluding the scenario that theoretically you could turn this material into something good. I'm just saying right now, especially, and I'll say this precisely at this historical moment, maybe if we had just sworn in Deval Patrick to follow Barack Obama and we had like a national, you know, commission on like depolicing society, whatever, you know, I'm being cheeky, but you got my point. So, okay. But then there's a second scenario, which is that it's, you know, or I should say there's four scenarios. Okay. First is it doesn't happen. Second scenario is it happens and it sucks critically, historically, and as an entertainment proposition. Third is that it sucks historically and critically is maybe somewhere in the middle, but a lot of people find it very entertaining and it sort of has a life. And then fourth is the minute, microscopic, like butterfly effect, chaos theory, fraction of a percent that they actually figure out how to do something here that's smart and effective and new and potentially teaches us a new lesson. But yeah. Somewhere in that two and three scenario, I mean, you know, disturbing possibilities lie, and I just can't discount them.
Yeah, I mean, I've been wrong
right.
a lot. You know,
yeah,
like
no,
that,
no,
that's
yeah, of course,
definitely
yeah. as all of us have, obviously.
You know, it's just again, I look at this team, and I just wonder. Like again, I'm just going to speak about the business perspective of right. like these guys are, as the showrunners for Game of Thrones are getting a lot of credit, and they're getting a huge opportunity, right?
Right.
But I'm like, really, that Game of Thrones shit ain't really on you. Like, you didn't really come up with yeah. all that shit. Like, you.
Some nerd wrote some books.
Yeah. George R. R. Martin adapted, made a great book. You guys adapted it. So you kind of caught lightning in a bottle, you right. know? And I don't know how much that prepares you, particularly when Game of Thrones itself has been so criticized for its poor take on diversity that you guys are the ones to walk in there and make this show. And my second piece that I've argued with friends that if you really want to do something dynamic and interesting and forward thinking that's going to include a lot of audiences and going to really blow my mind, I want to see the alternative history where we didn't develop under a system of white supremacy and capitalism.
Right.
Like, show me Europe was wiped out in 1100 due to bubonic plague and all the rest of the world developed without Columbus never came to the United
right.
States.
Right.
There was never the transatlantic slave trade. Like,
right.
show me that show.
Right.
That would be amazing. I'd watch that all day long.
Right.
You know, but
would it have the same easy opportunities for rape and plunder and violence?
Probably not.
Well, there you go. That's why your scenario doesn't happen.
But I think if you really want to think about alternative world views,
right?
You know, because then I think about all of these communities. Like, if we're facing all of these challenges, and maybe I'm making it too deep, right? But if we're facing a world that's on the brink of some real serious climate change, right?
Right.
And people who do a lot of work in that space, they often talk about going back to things that come from these other cultures. They come from indigenous cultures. We need to relearn these lessons. Why not show a world that never unlearned those lessons? You know, that learned to live in harmony with the world and never had an industrial revolution based on predatory capitalism that destroys everything. Like, make that show.
Yeah, but could there be a scenario where, like, as an example, a slave trader who's loosely based on Ramsay Bolton cut a girl's nipples off in that scenario?
You'd be missing the nipple cut.
Yeah, see, and I think that's basically what they have in mind, which is why I'm skeptical as fuck of this show. I actually think, honestly, if you were looking for, and this is just because he doesn't take him, I mean, he's ridiculous, but, like, you know, like, if you want to do, like, Grindhouse meets whatever nonsense historicism, like Quentin Tarantino did it, and think what you think of that movie. But I have a very strong feeling that movie's going to be better than this show. That movie was a problem too, but that movie was, but he went with, because that's the other part of it, is that they're not, you know, they want to be taken seriously. Yeah. They're not ridiculous gonzo guys. Quentin, at a certain point, you're like, you know, on paper, you turn slavery and the Holocaust into backdrops for grindhouse movies with quirky dialogue. What the fuck is wrong with you? But in practice, it's like, you somewhat entertaining.
And you're not taking it seriously.
You're not taking it
seriously. Right off the jump.
Right off the jump.
This is trying to be serious. And with The Man in the High Castle, because I push back on that, it's like, that was like a written book that was kind of adapted and changed and...
No, it's a different.
It's a different thing.
No, and yeah, I mean, the other basic difference is that Man in the High Castle. I think the real basic difference is if you could do a storyline that was based downstream from slavery still existing, because the major point is that they didn't do Germany in 2000 or what? No, that show isn't even modern day. It's like in the 50s or 60s, whatever. You didn't do like, we're going to set it in Germany after the Holocaust happened successfully. That's the distinction.
Yeah.
They're doing an alternative, you know, universe where the United States is occupied. And it actually is still quite disturbing in terms of like, there are Jew hunter characters and the Nazi eugenics are kind of in place. But the raw sort of visceral comparison would have to be, it's literally in the site where the crime took place. The only last thing on this though, do you think there's something, I mean, it's one of these, and I get annoyed at these conversations, but I've noticed that, you know, the people that they're doing it with, the husband and wife team, are both black. Some people are, you know, completely ignoring that, as we have in most of the conversation. But then on the flip side, what the Game of Thrones guys are doing is, you know, immediately deploying them as kind of, you know, sophisticated human shields to kind of move the storyline along. So I presented the question, I think it's clear what my take is on it. I'm still rolling my eyes. And I'm also frankly, you know, the other thing too is, and this is where I'm being snobby, but like, look, The Good Wife and Empire are fine shows, but they're not coming. If these two were from like comparable HBO prestige shows and had the same kind of heft behind them, but I also think that it's not just the breakdown of the power structure of that relationship in terms of their race and their respective prestige levels. It's also like, what have you been doing? These guys have been making the most important story in television, arguably, for the last several years, Game of Thrones, right? And, you know, and this couple have been on two, you know, very successful and very fun and very respected, but, you know, standard issue TV shows, basically.
Yeah, it's going to, I mean, these guys, we get the opportunities we get.
Right.
So I think I'm not going to shade them in the sense of saying, like, they're going into this with eyes wide open. Like, if you read their comments, they're well aware of the pushback. I feel like they understand they have a certain responsibility, but I think even our best intentions can sometimes work against us. And I just don't understand why this story needs to be told, you know. And I could go into a lot of other historical shit that we don't really have time for, but, you know, I could make social arguments as the, did the South lose the war? Like, I mean, there's,
right.
We're living in an electoral system that is still built on making sure that the South and lesser populated states have outsized power that's literally built because of slavery. So it's like, how deeply are you reimagining the world that we already live in? You know, prisons are pretty full. You know?
Yeah, there it is. That's what's up. We got to get to what's next.
Now we want to get to what's next. And we're going to be talking about a company called Brandless, which has a pretty interesting position in the consumer market world, or really consumer packaged goods, just to be a little bit more clear. They're recently featured in Fast Company, and we'll have this in the notes, where their brand initiative is to take away all of the fancy packaging, to take away all of the naming of products that we've all become familiar with, and just give you what they are. So if you look at, for example, a picture of their honey, it's not shaped like a bear. It's not like cute and has honeybees on it. It literally just says honey and has a list of what's in it, which is pretty much honey and some preservatives and what have you. And their whole idea was that what you're paying for when you buy a lot of brand name things is literally the packaging. So what they decided to do when they launched this on July 11th, so they're still very new, is to put out 115 essential products that range from condiments to kitchen appliances, and everything is going to be for $3 or less. So these are staples and essential items that really might not need the branding. It's granola, it's honey, it's tomato sauce. So it's not ragu with someone sailing in the Venetian canals. It's just,
they did it on ragu.
Well, the shit just says tomato sauce.
I was gonna say the Venetian canals and ragu, though.
I think so.
Damn.
You know, so it's an interesting take on simplifying the branding process, and my suspicion is that this is gonna actually be fairly successful. If I think about where I do most of my shopping, if it's not kind of local spots, my butcher guy, my, you know, my fish market, Trader Joe's has kind of pioneered this a little bit, where they have the Trader Joe's brand, but it's not the usual Procter and Gamble, Colgate products that we're all familiar with. It's just Trader Joe's, right. And their off brand itself has become a brand, but the items there are marketed as being more affordable.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only question that some people have is the quality of the product, not actually relative to, you know, most consumer brands, because most consumer brands are, you know, they're not obviously particularly healthy or lower in preservatives or chemicals or anything like that. I think from a health purchaser kind of perspective, I would have interest in, you know, are these any of these ingredients organic? You know, stuff like that. How are they preserved? I mean, I think that those are sort of the questions that I would ask. But I do think more broadly, I mean, this is the, you know, there's one iteration which is really disheartening and really a big problem of the sort of like disappearance of middle class brands and the notion that everything is either, you know, Saks Fifth Avenue or Walmart. And as the sort of consumer goods parallel to the, you know, the structural inequality crisis, I think now you're starting to see emerge, particularly, and this is where, you know, generations, you know, I think some of that demographic stuff matters in a slightly specific way, though it's still transcendent and values community based. But when you have, you know, through the combination of inequality issues, student debt, and diminish job prospects on the, you know, profoundly negative, destructive ends hitting millennials. But then on the flip side, you know, shifts in cultural attitudes about what priorities are in terms of where you want to live, how much you drive, how you relate to, you know, important consumption choices. I think you start to see an interesting breakdown where more people will start paralleling you in the sense that, well, I might want to make some, you know, really considered and higher quality decisions to buy certain foods from local and organic and humane and environmentally responsible sources, and that sort of, you know, real deep interest in community supported agriculture and, you know, farming and garden culture that's popped up in so many cities. And then on the other hand, that, you know, look, well, yeah, I don't need to have a bear in my honey. Maybe I'll go, you know, to the organic shop and drop $12 on some actual, like, you know, the honey glaze is still on the top and it's raw and you're doing all of that from a gourmet or a health perspective. But if you're not doing that, yeah, skip the, you know, $5-6 shit, get a nice under 3 sent directly to you. It's that kind of, it, in the sense that instead of Walmart being at the lower end, it becomes just these smart minimalist choices where you're eliminating a lot of bullshit.
Yeah, I think when I saw it for the first time, it's interesting because as much as you can say something is brandless, I'll backtrack a little bit because this goes back to a lot of what we used to call like knockoffs back in the day. Like you always had like the Kellogg cornflakes, and then you would have like the Key Food cornflakes that didn't quite, the box didn't quite look the same. They were kind of the off-brand alternative, you know, and or what they would call like generics. When I was growing up and, you know, my parents was struggling and I wanted like brand name sneakers. And my parents was like, fuck that. You ain't getting brand name sneakers. A, they didn't have the money. And B, cats was stealing your sneakers. So for like, until I was like 11, I wore what cats call rejects. You know, they were just off brand sneakers that my mom got from Alexander's, an old department store that don't even exist no more. She used to work there. And the laces.
But now you'll get a great joke from Get Shorty now.
But the sneakers used to be tied together, the laces, and you'd be shopping for them in a bin. So I say that to say that what I've noticed in recent years is that off-brand, generics, rejects, whatever you want to call them, have actually plussed up their branding to look cooler, slicker, more presentable. So when I look at these pictures of the brandless products,
they look very good.
They look really fucking cool.
Yeah.
Like they remind me of, if you go to any restaurant, diner, whatever, and you go to wash your hands, you're gonna, that most restaurants, I don't know how they manage to do this, but like Meijer's cleaning products has like cornered like that market.
Smell good, organic.
Like almost clean. Every restaurant I go to, they always have like the Meijer's soap in there. Like if there's a canister of soap. And if you look at the branding of Meijer's, it's very much like Sears catalog 1910. The writing, the logo, it makes something look very old and traditional. Like, hey, let's order it from the old Robux, you know?
Yeah.
And when I look at this company and the way their labels look, the bottles look, the jars, it has that same kind of clean design. So as much as it's brandless, it's still branded to hit certain notes. And that's what I think is actually really cool about what they're doing. They're stripping away a lot of the bells and whistles, cutting out those markups, and giving you something that actually looks really clean,
yeah,
and really attractive,
yeah.
That's very much in that, like Meijer's and Everlane is another brand.
It's totally in line with that minimalist aesthetic.
Yeah, which I think is actually really cool.
And that's a value. Yeah. And I think that that also is a values community right there, you know, and that relates to, you go to an earlier conversation we had with Piers Fox about the future of the work economy and, you know, these kind of digital nomad culture. There's definitely this sense, too, that people are looking to carry less and be less weighed down. And all of these products they do, they look like, wow, well, it's totally non-invasive in my space. It won't take up much room, but it actually also looks really pleasant.
Yeah.
And it's so that kind of efficient, elegant minimalism. I mean, that's, I don't think that's going anywhere.
No.
Like, I don't think that's, there's not going to be a backlash against that when people start to be like, well, I actually want like big janky shit again.
Yeah. And people want things to just work. It reminds me very quickly of the story in the spring of, and I hope I'm going to say the brand right, because I'm not a fashionista, Balenciaga, I think, or Balenciaga. They make like luxury bags and shit like that. And they basically created this bag that's like retails for over $2,000. And it looks exactly like the IKEA $5 bag that I'm sure in every major city, but definitely here in New York, becomes like everyone's de facto laundry bag, shopping errand bag. And IKEA had a lot of tongue in cheek about this when it came out. Like, people were comparing them side by side. And it, this bag could cost $2,000, but it looked exactly like the IKEA bag. And you see, like, these luxury brands are even trying to get in on the act of this kind of clean functionality of the IKEA bag. Well, we're just going to adapt that, but because we're a prestige luxury brand, we're going to charge $2,000 for it. And IKEA, like, kind of takes a piss out of them. So I think we're going to see more of this aesthetic, not less, that that people are just stripping away the nonsense. And if you are going to be playing in the brand space, you have to know how to do that in a way that's effective. Shinola is another example of that. It's watches that are cool, there's high craft, but they're not branding themselves like Rolex.
Right.
You know, in a way.
Right.
They're not serving that same market, and they're very successful at what they do by being clean, functional, and smart.
Yeah. So it's Japan, it's Japan and Scandinavian time.
Design
wise. And that's what's next. We gotta get to the crates. So now we gotta get to the crates. It's your pick from culture. And I'm gonna pick a recent essay that appeared in a website that everybody should be checking called commonstransition.org. And the piece is called Commons in the Time of Monsters, How P2P, which is peer-to-peer politics, can change the world one city at a time. And peer-to-peer politics has been pioneered by a Belgian activist and political theorist named Michel Bouwens, who's now based in Thailand. And what's really important about his work is he's not just chronicling the sort of initial promises of technology to kind of more greatly democratize the economy and politics. He also is taking the whole sweep of commons and peer-to-peer. So he's chronicling seed bank movements, pieces of political and indigenous environmental and social justice resistance, and sort of chronicling them on different platforms so that these threads connect. He also did some work in Ecuador on incorporating earth rights into their constitution. And this essay specifically, which isn't written by Michel Bouwens, but definitely owes something to his work, it's by Ana Maria Utral, is sort of about the kind of growing pangs, particularly in Europe, of some parties beginning to win and sort of gain power, at least at local levels, and in the case in some ways in Greece with Syriza, that are sort of incorporating some of these ideas, and how, you know, they're still not being implemented. The world is still kind of being grinded under neoliberal austerity. And she quotes Gramsci, which is basically, and it's Mayor Nappy Gramsci. It's, this could be a improperly attributed quote to him, but the old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. And she says, after 4 years of progressive neoliberalization and social decomposition, contemporary politics has been very publicly upended by misogynistic, xenophobic, and financially privileged quote unquote new right, intent uncoupling its politics of hate onto the apparatus of state power. So it's a really good essay because it very accurately describes the crisis of the moment and then actually specifically how starting cities by, you know, city to city, this new and radically different and far better and really kind of humanity saving politics can emerge. So check it out. That's my pick.
My pick is a book that I just got and have gone about halfway through. It's very short because it's a collection of essays, and it's called Will the Flower Slip Through the Asphalt? The subtitle, Writers Respond to Capitalist Climate Change. And it's edited by Vijay Prashad, who I love.
He's brilliant.
Quite a few of his books. He's great. And some of the writers included in this are Naomi Klein, Carlos Drummond, De Andrade, John Bellamy Foster, Shalini Singh, Susan Abulawa, Rafia Zakaria. So there's a collection.
Love Rafia Zakaria too.
There's a great collection of contributors to this collection of essays. It's not overly long, but what it attempts to do is connect the climate change and climate crisis to the different ways in which the capitalist system works and operates. So it looks to connect some dots, and in keeping with our show, some of these dots are not seen. So they're kind of adopting this idea that they have to put things together in a way that people might not be thinking about them. I'm about halfway through and have really enjoyed it. It makes you think, and that's what we're all about, giving you something to think. So again, I would highly recommend checking out that book. The title again, Will the Flower Slip Through the Asphalt? Writers Respond to Capitalist Climate Change.
Another expedition. Thank you, brother. Thank you, super producer Matt Leck. See you soon for more Dope Boys.